I'll just tell you, as I take a quick glance around, that a version of this paper was delivered some weeks ago in a Mormon counselor conference setting. So if any of you were there, this is kind of the, I don't know whether it's any more polished or not, but another version. What I'm going to be sharing is an issue that is for me one of a continuing concern, and I'm really pleased in a way that we don't have anyone responding. I'm interested in your response and any opportunity we may have then after I've shared some of this to talk and to raise questions and share insights and concerns. So let me begin. In a shrewd phrase, Henry Miller speaks of the immorality of morality. Albert Schweitzer contends that the good conscience is the invention of the devil. And Alfred North Whitehead suggests that the simple-minded use of the notions right and wrong is one of the chief obstacles to the development of ethical awareness. To these statements, I would add the observation that religion often stands as a deterrent to the development of spirituality. Let an anecdote shared by Joseph Fletcher serve as a means of underscoring the tone and intent of these statements. A friend of Fletcher's arrived in St. Louis just as the presidential campaign was ending, and the cab driver, not being above the battle, volunteered his testimony. "I and my father and grandfather before me and their fathers have always been straight-ticket Republicans," he said. "Oh," said Fletcher's friend, who is himself a Republican, "I take it that means you will vote for Senator so-and-so," who is the party candidate. "No," said the driver, "there are times when a man has to push his principles aside and do the right thing." The same concern is effectively expressed by the charge, "We're so full of what's right, we can't see what's good." And finally, the prayer of the little girl, "Oh Lord, make all of the bad people good and all of the good people nice." It is then the eagerness of our search for God and the good which can lead us astray. This is a disturbing notion because we understand intuitively that the honoring of the human in human being is inextricably linked with a passionate quest for truth and for the good. The quest is essential, but our very commitment to it can be our undoing. We so often succumb to the tendency to twist and bend good to the service of evil. Why? What is there within us which gives rise to this problem? Let us eavesdrop on a hypothetical conversation between a young woman and her LDS bishop. The young woman sought an interview with her bishop because she felt, to use the current expression, burned out. For some time now, she's been struggling with a vague uneasiness, her word, as she describes it, the sense that she is not connecting with life. In her discussion with a bishop, she emphasized how hard she had been trying, and she reaffirms her commitment and her testimony of the gospel and her desire to be righteous, to serve, and to do the bidding of the Lord. Problem is that with all of that, she feels unfulfilled, anxious, and confused. Bishop's response startled the young woman. The thrust of his comments was something like the following: "I perceive that your problem is that you are trying to do your duty. You're trying to be happy. You're trying to win. You're trying to go to the celestial kingdom. You're trying to feel safe and secure. You're trying to be obedient. You're trying to be righteous. You're working very hard at being humble. I believe we are eavesdropping on a wise bishop, and that in this counseling session, he is inviting the young woman to embark upon an essential but potentially dangerous journey toward enlightenment. What are the insights the bishop wishes to share with the young woman? Obviously, he will work very hard not to be understood by her to be saying that duty, obedience, righteousness, humility, and so on, are not matters of appropriate concern. Perhaps he will end up suggesting that the problem is with the vantage point from which she pursues such virtues, but that sounds still a bit vague. We have more work to do if we were to second-guess the bishop or provide our own response to the all-too-common complaints of the young woman. I believe the portion of the bishop's comments we overheard suggests that his concern is very much in keeping with that of many of the Old Testament prophets and Jesus, as they railed against many of the religious practices of their day. We are familiar with the oft-quoted denunciation issued by Amos. I despise your feast days, and I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though ye offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs. The terminology and setting are different, but this sounds very much like the bishop saying to the young woman, I'm troubled by your devotion to duty, by your desire to be righteous, by your efforts to be humble, by your anxious striving to merit the celestial kingdom. Of course, the most familiar and most passionate denunciation of a particular style of religious involvement is Christ's condemnation of the Pharisees, as recorded in so many places. Matthew 23 is an important one among them. What emerges as the fundamental problem here? What is the issue? There's nothing more useless than a solution for which there is no problem. So what is the problem? What is it about the religious practices of their day which evoked the condemnation of Jesus and the prophets? In the essence of it, what is it? And what troubles the bishop about the young woman's style of religious involvement? Perhaps a statement from one of George Bernard Shaw's plays will provide an updated version of these condemnations and a possible interpretation of the general thrust and meaning of them. I quote, "In this palace of lies, a truth or two will not hurt you. Your friends are the dullest dogs I know. They're not beautiful, they're only decorated. They're not clean, they're only shaved and starched. They're not dignified, they're only fashionably dressed. They're not educated, they're only college pass men. They're not religious, they're only pew renters. They're not moral, they're only conventional. They're not virtuous, they're only cowardly. They're not even vicious, they're only frail. They're not loyal, they're servile. They're not dutiful, only sheepish. They're not public-spirited, only patriotic. Not courageous, only quarrelsome. Not determined, only obstinate. Not considerate, only polite." And I take a breath. "Not intelligent, only opinionated. Not imaginative, only superstitious. Not disciplined, only cowed. And not truthful at all. Liars, every one of them, to the very backbone of their souls." End of quote. Shaw's describing people who play to the gallery. People who are caught within the debilitating, stifling prison of self-concern. And I believe Jesus and the prophets were condemning the religious observances of people who suffered essentially from the same problem. The passion which is so evident in Jesus' condemnation issues from an awareness of our tendency to take the very key which could liberate us from the prison of narcissism and transform it into the heaviest bolt on the door. Why? What is the structural flaw, if you will, which manifests itself in this problem? I believe the ultimate answer, simply put, is distorted images of God and therefore of self. What is required is what someone has referred to as a psycho-spiritual tectonic shift, a major revamping of our fundamental assumptions concerning the nature of God and man. Traditional theologies, all arguments to the contrary, and notwithstanding, cast man in the role of an ontological cipher. The basic assumptions of these theologies portray him as being at the mercy of a God who enjoys a monopoly of power. This ever watchful, and all-powerful God tests man's obedience and worthiness with various configurations of reality. The world becomes a stage on which to perform, and the events of life are viewed as a series of deliberately designed obstacles and challenges orchestrated to produce a life experience something akin to struggling to get the page turned, to get through a police or military training course. It is important to note that to the degree that you espouse these basic assumptions, you come to believe that everything happens to you. To you. You are the center of attention. What matters is your performance. Let us underscore the need for a psycho-spiritual tectonic shift by admitting finally that man's metaphysical impotence has been a basic assumption of almost all traditional cultures. This is why this assumption and its implications are rooted so deeply within our very psyche. To live within such a theological, philosophical frame of reference is to inevitably fashion moralities and use religious involvement as a means of justifying ourselves before God, others, and self. In other words, the tendency toward narcissism is a manifestation of metaphysical distortions. In this regard, it is interesting to note that many references to blindness, which are woven as a single thread of emphasis through Christ's denunciation of the Pharisees, The obsession with self, which characterized the mode of being manifested by Amos's people, the Pharisees, and the young woman who sought the help of her bishop, does not manifest an innate character flaw, but issues from ignorance. Let us now be more thorough in portraying the sense of self and life, which issues from a religion based on a thoroughly external control system, which most religious systems are, in fact. Within such a frame of reference, the whole world tends to be used as a huge echo chamber and feeds back to us the signals or experiences we need to construct our own moral personalities. All relationships, institutions, and events serve as instruments for our tendency toward predatory self-assertion. Stated another way, we perform not with or for the benefit of others, but by the means of others. Other persons become interesting only as instruments for our fulfillment or as objects for our dedication. The presence of other people, particularly suffering people, grant us the opportunity to be devoted and loving. And that is where our focus is, on being devoted and loving. This is what Alan Watts had in mind when he stated that nothing is really more inhuman than human relations based on morals. That is, he continues, when a man gives bread in order to be charitable, he's as cold as a clam. He does not actually see the other person. I must be right, good, a real person, heroic, loving, self-effacing. I have effaced myself in order to assert myself. I give myself away in order to keep myself. The whole thing is a contradiction. We have always been haunted by the feeling that the sins of the saints are worse than the sins of the sinners. We sense that in some mysterious way, the one who is struggling for salvation is nearer to hell and the heart of evil than the unashamed harlot or a thief. The would-be saint walks straight into the meshes of this web because he would become a saint. End of quote. Remember that the root, as I'm suggesting, of all of this is to be found within our perception of God. For the theist, images of God provide the frame of reference within which he, she forms images of self. And these same images constitute a kind of screen through which he then views, or she views, the world. While it is true that our awareness of God, if it is to be authentic, must have an experiential component, we must not lose sight of the fact that our experiences, even of God, are filtered through a conceptual screen, just as there is an imaginative or conceptual element built into one's very sense of self. This capacity to conceptualize is among our most precious and distinctive possessions as human beings. But if we let it run wild, it can also be the source of our undoing. Historians and anthropologists have achieved a vantage point which impresses them with the way in which dehumanizing social institutions, superstitious beliefs, and religious sanctions are thoroughly intertwined and mutually reinforcing. That which provides the ground floor lighting for all of these systems, particularly in traditional cultures, is a view of the real power behind the scenes, that is, a view of God. This point underscores the importance of the discipline of theology. In the words of Gordon Kaufman, from the point of view of our further humanization, some images of God, including some with roots in the Bible and in certain strands of Christian tradition, are exceedingly dangerous. And worship of such gods will only further human depravity. It is not enough, then, to advocate devotion to God if human well-being and development is our concern. Devotion to some conceptions of God is dehumanizing, and it is little wonder that many great humanitarian reformers in past and present have found it necessary to disassociate themselves from the traditional Christian beliefs and to take an agnostic or atheistic position. We must be prepared to radically criticize and reconstruct traditional ideas of deity if God is to continue to serve as an appropriate object of devotion for our time. End of Kaufman. That goes well with Joseph Smith saying the first principle of the gospel is to know for a certainty, how did he say, the true character of God. First principle of the gospel I take to mean, he's not talking about faith in the traditional sense, but the foundational principle, that which provides the cornerstone for everything that follows. Took that water pretty late because I'm almost through. I wish now to provide a brief sketch of the essential points as I see them to be found within what I'm calling the traditional religious perspective. And there are just two or three of these, and you may want to give a pretty good ear to these because you may want to respond to these as we have opportunity to talk. The first and most basic point in what I'm calling the traditional religious perspective is that God is to be understood as controlling power. All things, allowing no exceptions, are possible to God. This implies that all that occurs in the world is ultimately in keeping with God's will. And here, you see, is the soil out of which grows the belief that nothing can or will be different, which leads to a passive-reactive lifestyle. The further implication is that God is really not out to accomplish anything. After all, if he enjoys a monopoly of power, the world is already his. His primary concern is to test our obedience and worthiness, and therefore that is our concern. I want to underscore that. If his primary concern is to test our obedience and worthiness, then that is our primary concern. Even as I hand you bread, I'm more concerned about my worthiness and obedience than I am about your hunger. The second notion is that God originates and lays down the rules of the game and punishes offenders and rewards the obedient. Some of the corollaries of these notions are the world becomes a kind of stage, as we said before, on which to perform, or a kind of gymnasium in which to develop myself. Since God is in control, the real issue has to do with my performance, but not for the sake of a contribution I can make. How could I contribute to the contours of a reality which is fashioned by God, which are fashioned by God? The second corollary of these notions concerning God is that to the degree that I take them seriously, I will develop an anxious turned inwardness. Now we're back to the woman who sought the bishop's counsel and advice. I will inevitably fall victim to the narcissism, which was alluded to earlier. I will tragically spend my life attempting the impossible. That is, I will spend my life trying to be good. And now we're at the root of the problem, for with Viktor Frankl we recognize and affirm that human fulfillment requires that the self becomes subject and not the object of existence. Now again, I'm suggesting that that will never be in the context of what I'm calling, again, traditional religious notions. The traditional religious perspective makes human fulfillment in that regard impossible, and because that perspective locks its adherents within the prison of self-concern, I believe the young woman who sought the aid of her bishop was experiencing the stifling and debilitating nature of that prison. I believe the portion of the bishop's counsel which we overheard suggests that he understood her problem. Remember, I perceive, he said, that your problem is that you're trying to be good, dutiful, and humble, and that you're trying to be obedient. You're trying to merit the celestial kingdom. My fantasy in playing out that hypothetical encounter between the young woman and the bishop is that he would not have counseled her to exercise more faith, with the expectation that somehow things would then work out, but that he would, in fact, have pointed out to her that her faith is not the problem. The problem has to do with the way she is objectifying her faith. In my mind's eye, I see the bishop endeavoring to lead the young woman to an awareness that she is caught within the traditional religious perspective and that it is that perspective which creates the screaming need to justify herself, to prove her worth, to do the bidding of the ever-watchful, all-controlling eye. It is that perspective of spirituality. Recall that the young woman complained of feeling burned out. Self-consciously in pursuit of righteousness is like trying to imitate the high tides of the soul. It's like trying to produce an effect without cause. That's tiring. It is the drumbeat of the futile, self-oriented striving which has sucked the life out of this young woman and which could make her a very likely candidate for either the role of continuing drudge or a member of the rank and file of those who have concluded that true life is to be found outside the pale of religious experience. I believe that such a conclusion is misguided, but I fear the ranks of those who see such a conclusion to be their best alternative will continue to swell unless we become more willing to engage in the difficult but rewarding task of an alternative to what I am calling the traditional religious perspective. Furthermore, I am convinced that there is to be found within the distinctive features of the LDS theological thought the seed ideas of that alternative perspective. But I agree with B.H. Roberts that we have hardly begun to plant. We need to get at it because we desperately need the life-giving nourishment of the harvest. I haven't the time to attempt even a rough sketch of what could replace the traditional perspective. I've tried to do that on other occasions, and so have many others more able than I. But think for a moment of the impact of bringing into view a God who has become fascinated with a magnificent possibility, the enhancement of the quality of existence. The world is not a stage. It is a cultivatable garden. By the dictates of reality, God's modus operandi is persuasion, not coercion. By the dictates of reality and by the dictates of his own nature, his way is persuasion, and he requires our free and creative participation. It is creative participation rather than anxious performance which he attempts to elicit from us. In this frame of reference, God is not the observer from behind the scenes, but rather the senior cultivator in the garden who beckons us to assist him, not for the practice, but because he needs us. Rather than devoting ourselves to the self-defeating purpose of being righteous, dutiful, good, or trying to go to heaven, God would have us participate in the redemption of the world. And then our righteousness is evoked as a corollary. The world, said Abraham Heschel, is unredeemed and deficient, and God is in need of man to be a partner in completing, in aiding, and in redeeming the world. I'm not forgetting that God is the source of all redemption, he says, but again, man holds the keys that unlocks the chains fettering the Redeemer. Here we begin to see a way out of the prison. We are catching just glimpses of an alternative theological frame of reference which our bishop would endeavor to share with a troubled young woman, a perspective which would evoke from her and from all of us a liberating self-transcendence. And it is that self-transcendence which is the very key, the very key. And so I close with a quote regarding that self-transcendence from one who has focused on it so much in his writings and who has, I think, demonstrated it in his life, again, Viktor Frankl. I love this image that he uses. I have come to understand the primordial anthropological fact that being human, the essence of being human, is to always be directed and pointed to something or someone other than oneself. To have a meaning to fulfill or another human being to encounter, a cause to serve, a person to love, only to the extent that someone is living out this essential self-transcendence, is he, she truly human? Or does he, she become his, her true self? He becomes, she becomes so not by concerning himself, herself, see how careful I'm trying to be, with actualization, but by this outward focus. Now, here's the analogy I love. Consider the eye, an analogy he says I'm fond of invoking. When, apart from looking in a mirror, does the eye see anything of itself? An eye with a cataract may see something like a cloud, which is the cataract. It's diseased. An eye with glaucoma may see its glaucoma as a rainbow halo around the lights. A healthy eye sees nothing of itself. It is self-transcendent. End of quote. Troubled young woman suffers from spiritual glaucoma. Part of the cure is, I believe, to turn away from the, we'll use this wording again, traditional religious perspective. Thanks very much.
Do you want to stand with the microphone?
was kind of thinking about sitting down.
Okay. Sitting down with the microphone?
I'll stand. That's
fine. Oh, it's fine. You can't just sit here. This comes off.
It's okay. I'll just sit and take a drink.
Okay.
They may not have anything to say.
Oh. Does anyone have any questions? Mimi?
I don't have a question.
Wait. Well, let me
well,
just...
I can talk about it now. I don't have a question.
Did you repeat her question?
Okay.
It struck me that this young woman was living by the shoulds, what you mentioned. She should have been doing all these things, and she felt like she needed to obey the religious injunctions of the church. And that's a legitimate state or stage for anybody who grows up in the church. The church is a paternal institution, and it tells the people how they should live. That would be the first or the second step in the self-image. But then when you grow more advanced or older, you begin to question some of those shoulds. And that's where the development comes in. What do I want? Not what the church wants, but that also where the conflicts are.
Well, you are a very optimistic person.
How is that?
You say when we grow older, we begin to do
that. That's the microphone.
Ah. I was interested in that comment. I mean, when we grow older, we begin to, and that's wonderful, I hope. You do.
Are you saying that we're born ourselves?
No, I'm saying that most of us do not. You know, we're born into this world looking at kneecaps and belt buckles. That's how we grow up, and some of us emotionally and spiritually never get out of that. We're still looking to the powers that be, rather than, as you say, to begin to, I don't know whether you want to use the word question or look or come to one's own conclusions.
To come
or,
to your own self, not what you should do, but what you decide that this is what my life needs to be all about. And what you're saying is that our self-image does not change, does not grow, does not have any new facets.
I'm saying I hope it does.
Okay.
Seems to me that you're talking simply about the second commandment. Get outside yourself and love your neighbor. Not as yourself, but better than.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, then, I mean, if we do that, we aren't going to fall by the wayside of those shoulds.
Yeah, but the irony is what? The irony I was trying to point out is that if I'm doing that by way of commandment, then it's part of the gymnasium. It's part of, where's my focus? It's on me. And as I read so much of the Master said, he keeps talking to me about that focus being turned outward. And I guess part of what I'm suggesting is that the only way that focus can be turned outward is if we experience some, I use the word metaphysical changes in the way we perceive reality. Obviously, the way we perceive him and ourselves and the relationship between God and mankind. Excuse me.
It's just that then it's a matter of love. If you do something for someone because you love them, and because you would like their world to be better, rather than, am I not doing a noble thing?
Yep. Then it's love.
Then it's love.
Yeah.
Well, that isn't too hard. That must not be it. It must be harder than that.
That's pretty easy. Okay.
I'm excited by a new concept that Carlisle's introduced to me. I think this is a fun experience for me. In response to her comment, if I understand what Carlisle is saying, she's saying what you're really advocating is the second commandment to love your neighbor. And if I understand Carlisle correctly, what he's saying is we focus on the neighbor, we don't focus on the love. We're not worried about whether we're loving our neighbor. We're just worried about the neighbor.
There you go.
And it reminds me of something I heard once, and I'm not sure I understood it fully then, and I'm not sure I do now yet, but I think it kind of ties in, and that is they were talking about how to create a happy marriage, and they said happy marriages are not created by two people looking into one another's eyes. They're created by two people looking outward together.
Yes, come on up.
I think I'm hearing him say, run faster, Patty. Be perfect. And remain the little child, the objectified individual. Do what we tell you to do. And if we stay forever in that childish realm of obeying in hope of reward, we never really experience the Christ center of becoming adult and looking out because we truly love someone else. That makes sense?
Does indeed. Now, what I'm interested to have you comment on, you comment on anything you want, but I'm interested in the notion that I'm pushing here that there are some, that we are set up to play to the gallery by virtue of, again, what I was referring to as the traditional religious perspective. See, the part that really becomes a second chapter of this, we didn't have time today, is that where I just kind of nodded in the direction of saying that I believe that in certain really distinctive features of Mormon thought, which for me clearly move away from what I'm calling the traditional religious perspective, there are the seed ideas of this different perspective which could liberate us from playing to the gallery. You help me.
Question.
Okay, well, before you do, is that going to get us off?
It might.
Okay. So, yes. And then we'll come back.
Might this be the solution? It's the old theological concept of grace. And grace, maybe a Baptist, a good Baptist sitting here today, would have an easier time understanding the hurdle that you're asking him to make. Because they're not playing for the gallery, nor are they trying to achieve, in God's eyes, something, because they've already achieved it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. Interesting. Yes, sir? Come on up. Come on up.
I had wondered if really the problem you had here was a depressed girl who had not been able to achieve an overly high standard that had been that she'd set for herself, or had so constricted her life in her plotting to get to heaven that she had lost track of life. I think the bishop would have done better if he'd had some counseling advice along the line and would investigate what the girl was feeling and why. And what her goals were, what her assessment was, and to probe and help her. I think he just confused her.
You know, I think that the point I was trying to make is that a good counselor in a Mormon context is a good theologian. And that, again, though I did spend a lot of time in the paper spelling it out, that if he's going to solve her problem, it's ultimately a theological problem. I'm portraying her not as one who has any deep-seated so-called psychological issues as much as she has metaphysical issues, which then manifest in this kind of burned-out effort, anxious, turned-inward effort to do what she's supposed to do. Now, we ignored you, brother. Do you want to come up now?
You talked about this first stage you're establishing, and having read your Mormonism in a tragic sense of life, I agree with this first stage that you've talked about the need for a redefinition of God. I guess I'm more interested in the second stage, where we go from here. My question is in scriptures and so forth, we're told about things being gifts of God, even charity being a gift. In other words, we can't say I'm going to love and then achieve love. That at some point that's given to us, the feelings given to us, that even the change, the being born again. I'd like to maybe you to respond on that.
Where's the brother who talked about grace? It's in a sense he's talking about that, isn't he? The gift, it's evoked from me by we can use the word grace, can't we? The mighty change of heart, right?
Okay. But if we consciously say, hey, I'm going to be born again, I'm going to go out and be born again, it doesn't happen.
I think not.
I'm going to go out and love. It doesn't happen. Yeah.
You evoke that from me. You can evoke that from me, though, by how you treat me in some real sense. But it isn't a self-conscious effort on my part. If it's been evoked, it's been evoked. It's pulled from me. All right? So I manifest it without trying to.
There's nothing I'd like more than to agree with you, Carlisle, because I love you deeply, but I don't agree with you at all. I do agree that the problem is theological, but I only believe that in terms that theology created the problem with such craziness as the need of redemption. That is, that the creation of God is no darn good. That is, that it's faulty at its core, and therefore requires, and that means that we are faulty at our cores. And I just don't buy into that anymore. That's when I gave up traditional. That's one of the traditional that I gave up, because I don't believe that creation is faulty. I think creation is doing, that is, the process of creation continues. We're all a part of it. Our growing up is all part of it. And I don't believe in a theological cure unless we acknowledge that theology created the problem. Then I buy into it that since you created it, you got to undo everything that craziness created. And instead of accepting our existence as something as exquisite, even if it's for a moment and even if it's painful. Well, if you can figure out a way to make that agreement, I'll feel much better tonight.
Yes. Thanks. I think one of the problems about playing to the gallery is the fact that we are playing roles. And it's been my experience, this is one of the most detrimental things in marriage, this role-playing business, that so many people marry someone and expect them to play roles. And there's no gift of love freely given. My feeling is, if you see something that needs to be done and you can do it, why not do it without calculating everything? And I think that's one of the downfall of our marriages today, is this role-playing business.
Trying to arrange ourselves and our performance to meet certain expectations.
Right. Instead of just freely giving love and doing what we can to help the relationship whenever the opportunity arises.
I'll have to disagree with you, Ardeen. I think sometimes religion does not solve the problem of helping us to find joy and happiness, but I don't think it always creates the problem. Otherwise, the people who had no religion will all be happy, and I don't think they are. Going back to the issue of grace, in traditional Christianity, one of the purposes of the law is to break our hearts. The person who tries really hard to keep all of the rules and obligations, finally they'll come to the point that their heart is broken and they realize it's impossible. I can't do it. No matter how hard I try, this is an impossible task. And at that point, the person is able to open himself or herself to receive the grace of God. Because, you know, without realizing, a lot of us go through life and we think, if I just tried a little harder, or I did this or that, I could do it. But the person who's really tried and is able to come to this point, I think they can say, yes, I need the grace of God. And then when we realize that no matter what we do, we are going to be incomplete, unhappy in some sense. We're going to be a sinner. We can't be a perfect person on our own. We can open ourselves to receive the grace of God, and then we can act not out of obligation but out of love. We can give as we have been given to. And it's not, we recognize it's not coming from us, it's coming from a greater source outside of ourselves.
Okay, I don't know if it's fair that you go ahead and use my story about talking to the bishop. But I'm not the only girl that's probably gone through that. You're like, hello, why am I not feeling like this is working? And he didn't give me the advice that I was trying too hard. He said, you need to be more faithful. And he didn't say, just relax and be yourself. And that kind of is what I found needed to be done, but I'm not sure how to go through that transition, if I could go through that again, or those that are around me. You're always playing to a gallery because you need to be accepted. You need to be accepted whether it's the big gallery that the church is playing or if it's just your little community like this one here. You need that acceptance, but you need to also be comfortable with being rejected from them, and I think that's what I hit when I decided it's not a matter of me not being faithful enough. You know, I'd go around thinking, oh, I need to be better. I need to be more nice to these people. And that didn't cut it. And I'm sure every one of you have experienced that. Whether you want to admit it or not is up to you.
But is it better now?
It's a lot better.
Okay. Yes.
As she spoke, saying, I need to be better to these people, the thought occurs to me that some psychiatrists recommend that if you can't feel something that you feel you ought to feel, like charity, act like you feel that way, and then the feeling will come to you. And is there any validity in that? I mean, can you play to the what's the phrase? Play to the gallery, you know, pretend like you're doing the right thing, and then it'll come as a natural.
Well, but it's interesting. If I stand up and say to you, I will admit to you that I do not have depth of feeling about X part of the gospel, and you say to me, well, it's hang in there and continue and do this and this and this and so on, and then I agree to do that, I don't think that necessarily constitutes playing to the gallery. I've admitted my issue. I've admitted the concern. You've given me some feedback on what to continue to do and so on. Except that it may well be that there can come a real sort of epiphany in which I am so caught up in some need out there, some something out there that I all at once feel passionate about for its own sake. By the way, you remember that some of you read the rather fancy word in my title, autotelic. You familiar with that term? Auto, self, or freely. So the auto part of that is to suggest self or freely chosen. Telic is end or purpose, or so it's a freely chosen for its own sake. Both parts of that phraseology important. Freely chosen for its own sake. I choose freely to go down and give bread for the sake of the fact that they're hungry. Freely chosen for its own sake versus I'm doing it because if I don't, there may some statement in my not doing it about who I am and about how this gallery is going to respond to me and so on and so on. Yes, sir.
I get the impression that we're brainwashed from almost day one by people trying to teach us from their experience, and we're given promises of great rewards, a lot of big real estate in the celestial kingdom, if we follow these rules. And we become very self-centered in trying to advance ourselves as we are taught. This seems in contradiction to the other thing we're taught, be therefore perfect. And we imply that to have all the elements of goody, goody, goody. Whereas I think the root word perfect in the scripture means be complete. Be therefore complete. Well, in the long run, we won't be complete until eons into the afterlife. And the root solution to me is to say that I am told to be complete and recognize a thing we don't like to accept. That is that we are literal children of God and that I am a God. I am a God in the making. And that right now I can be godlike. It's hard. But I wonder if putting that element into it, that I am a God, therefore I do self-select what is right because I am a God, not to meet somebody else's God.
So should I try to be godlike?
No,
that's right. Well, I pose the question, should I try to be godlike? And if I am, doesn't that put me back in the same ball game that we've been talking about? And the notion that I should be perfect, except that I liked your comment, the only way I can make sense of that is perfect is whole, wholeness, or if you will, integrated, so all of a piece, not part of me looking at, and so pure in that sense, complete, whole. You say what? Yeah. Then it's already. Then I'm already there in a sense, huh? Yeah.
Yes.
But if I understand what you're saying, is the problem is that we're always thinking I. What can I? What can I do? What can I become?
Yeah.
So how do we get rid of the I?
Don't worry.
Yes. Let me just address this question as we I guess come to a close here, don't we? Let me get into just a kind of closing comment I want to make by the statement from Emerson that some of you are familiar with. He said, "My life, finally, I like that part of the wording. My life finally is for itself." And not for a spectacle. Then he completed that with a statement that many of you have heard. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who in the midst of the crowd keeps with perfect sweetness, the independence of solitude. And part of what I was trying to suggest in my paper, and really the issue that we need to take up in more detail as a kind of second chapter, is that in effect, the traditional religious perspective does not give us any solitude, even when we're alone. Thank you.